Welcome to the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM. I am Phil Taylor, your host. Today we are going to be speaking to Zafar Bengash, Crescent International. And Zafar, as our listeners know, is an authority on Islam and, of course, matters to do with the Middle East and around the world. Welcome to the show, Zafar.
Thank you very much, Phil. It's my great pleasure to be with you once again.
Well, we have urgent needs here. We have to understand what these big events, and they are really coming fast and furious, these events. We've had an explosion in the port of Beirut, nearly wiping out grain silos, killing people, destroying part of the city. We've had a visit there by Mr. Macron, an amazingly quick visit by a European leader, and the most visible leader so far, I believe, to go to Beirut following the blast. But we've also had suddenly an agreement struck between United Arab Emirates and Israel, and the agreement was announced by none other than Donald Trump, the President of the United States. Following on that, just to list some of the headaches we want you to address, the United Nations Security Council had a resolution from the United States wanting to have further embargo against the Islamic Republic, but they lost. The only country that voted for the United States motion was Dominican Republic. Following that, we've also had now in the last 24 hours, I think we have learned that the United States has seized some oil tankers, which have, I don't know if they are Iranian oil tankers, but they contain Iranian fuel, I believe, and I think it was destined, they say it was destined, for Venezuela. Let's begin with this blast. What is your analysis of what took place there and how, and the response, particularly the political fallout involving the organization called Hezbollah?
Well, there's a whole lot of detail involved there. We know that a blast occurred on August the 4th. And in that blast, something like 170 people have been killed so far. There are dozens of people still missing. Something like 6,000 people have been injured and about 300,000 people in Beirut have been virtually made homeless because their apartments and homes, etc., have been demolished. Now we need to keep in mind that Beirut itself, the city, has a total population of 2 million. So out of 2 million, if you have 300,000 people that are made homeless, we are talking percent of the population right now is homeless in Beirut. And of course, the people that have been killed belong to all groups, all denominations, et cetera, et cetera. This has, of course, led to the resignation of the government that was sworn in only last February. But the irony of this whole thing is that this government that has been forced to resign had nothing to do whatsoever with the security at Beirut Airport. Let me explain to you. Unfortunately, because of the confessional nature of politics in Lebanon, there are two authorities that are responsible for Beirut. There is the customs authority. Of course, you know, anything that comes through a port, and 80% of Lebanese imports come through Beirut port. The customs authority is under the direct control of the Lebanese president, Michel Aoun. And then you have the port authority itself, which is basically managing the affairs of the port. And those are under the control of Saad Hariri's group, who is the former prime minister, who leads a faction or a political group called Future Movement. And I'm sure that your listeners would probably have read some reports alleging that Beirut was under Hezbollah's control. That is completely false. Hezbollah had absolutely nothing to do with the Beirut port, because, as I mentioned, the port facilities were all under the control of Saad Hariri, who is an enemy of Hezbollah, and he's a Saudi citizen who happened to be, imagine being a prime minister of Lebanon. He's closely aligned with the United States and France, and he takes orders from them. And in fact, even these demonstrations that have been taking place in Lebanon against, lack of food and economic opportunities, etc., all of these demonstrations have actually been financed by the Hariri faction, because they wanted to bring down this government. And how the blast occurred, there are different theories. So far, what has emerged is that there was something like 2,750 tons of ammonium nitrate that was confiscated from a Moldovan registered ship that was taking this ammonium nitrate from Georgia to Mozambique, to a company in Mozambique. And it docked at Beirut port because of two reasons. Number one, the ship, it was an old ship, it was leaking. And number two, the owner of the ship told the captain to go to Beirut, pick up some heavy construction equipment and deliver it to Jordan before proceeding to Mozambique. So when the ship docked at Beirut port, and of course the Lebanese wanted to put that that construction equipment, load that construction equipment onto the ship, holding doors started to buckle because this construction equipment was very heavy. And so then the Lebanese port authorities inspected the ship and they found that it was not seaworthy. So they ordered the owners of the ship to first of all pay port charges, and number two, to repair the ship because it is not seaworthy. Of course, the owner just abandoned the ship and disappeared, and the Lebanese unloaded this cargo and put it in a storage place at Beirut port in June of 2014. I imagine, ammonium nitrate can be used as a fertilizer, but more importantly, it is used as an explosive. And so from June 2014 to the present time, to the time that the blast occurred, this approximately 3,000 tons of ammonium nitrate lay there. And even though the people at the port, particularly from customs, there is a customs official by the name of Shafiq Mehri, who's director of Lebanese customs. Between 2014 and 2017, he sent six letters to the Lebanese government urging them to do something about this ammonium nitrate because it is lying in an area which is a danger to public safety if something were to happen. Now, the stories that have emerged is the way the explosion occurred, that there was some welding taking place over there, and the sparks from there apparently set off some fireworks that incidentally had been imported by the Hariri faction people that were also lying there, because these people use fireworks, etc., against the police and security forces when they are demonstrating in Beirut. And once the fireworks caught fire, the explosions from that set fire to ammonium nitrate, and we had that massive explosion. This is one explanation. There are various theories, although nobody has said so specifically, but there are also theories. A couple of people have actually highlighted them. One is this American Israeli writer Richard Silverstein, who has said that the second explosion actually was an Israeli attack on that ammonium nitrate. And there is also another article by Philip Giraldi, who's a former CIA operative, and now he is the executive director of Council for the National Interest. Mm-hmm. He also is of the opinion that perhaps Israel had used a tactical nuclear weapon. We yeah. don't know for sure. And of course, the Lebanese government has instituted a commission of inquiry. Yes.
I'm sorry to cut you that way, but I want to make sure I ask you this question at this point. Now we're in this mode of there has to be an investigation. So, you know, when you have this much damage and anger, political anger, and you have international players, Saudi Arabia, United States, France, as well as the various political factions, who will investigate, and how can this happen with it, where you end up with more confidence? So, like you raised, many people are speculating, and everybody says there'll be an investigation. By whom?
That's a good question. Actually, there is now a caretaker government in Lebanon, and the Lebanese parliament approved this investigation. So there is a commission of inquiry that has been established. And both the Lebanese president, Michel Aoun, as well as Hezbollah leader, Sayed Nasrallah, day before yesterday, or actually in a speech on Thursday, August the 13th, he said that we need to wait for this investigation. Both of them alluded to the fact that we need to find out whether it was only negligence and incompetence on the part of the Lebanese authority or there were any external players involved in it. As you mentioned, obviously, there are many external players, the French, the Saudis, the Americans, etc. They're all, in fact, right now, there are basically even calls that, you know, there should be an international mandate to take over Lebanon.
Yeah.
So they can manage it. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, this is basically brazen imperialism that is being suggested. So if, let's say, they succeed. I don't think they will, because now there is considerable political will and strength inside Lebanon, particularly represented by Hezbollah, that they would not allow any such thing to take place. But it points to the imperialist mindset that exists in terms of how they think that they can manipulate other countries and dictate their own policies.
Indeed. Explain to us, who invited, that's my question, who guaranteed the rapid visit of Macron? Why wouldn't, if you want to build unity, why wouldn't they bring three or four leaders from various places who want to help Beirut? Who was it?
Exactly. I mean, it was basically Macron's rapid deployment to Lebanon. He arrives at Beirut airport and he's sort of, you know, I think it is clear that it was the Hariri faction that had invited him to Lebanon and brought him there. And in the chaos, you know, obviously the government was under tremendous pressure. They couldn't do anything about it. And he went about basically acting as if he's the, you know, a viceroy or some kind of an imperial, you know, governor roaming around making demands that Lebanon should do this and Lebanon should do that, etc., etc.
Who to say no blank check? What an insult to a devastated a people under sanctions, and he says to them, no blank check.
Exactly. This is the kind of sort of, you know, mind-boggling hypocrisy that exists over there, and it targets, unfortunately, the ordinary people. And you can contrast this with the attitude of Iran, which immediately sent three plane loads of medicines and tents and food, because Lebanon's, as you mentioned, the grain silos at the airport have also been destroyed. And since 80% of all the food or everything that is imported into Lebanon goes through that port in Beirut, obviously there is going to be massive food shortages. So Iran immediately, despite the fact that Iran is suffering from massive American sanctions for decades, it still sent medicines, medical teams, field hospitals, food, etc., to the Lebanese people. And then on August the 13th, Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, visited Lebanon, and he said that the future government of Lebanon has to be decided by the Lebanese people. It should not be dictated by outside powers. And it was a clear reference both to Macron's statements as well as American statements demanding that there have to be reforms and we're not going to give blank check and, you know, Lebanon should do this or that before any aid would come through. So it indicates that as far as Iran is concerned, and incidentally also Syria, which opened its border to Lebanese to go to Syria because Lebanese hospitals are totally overwhelmed. They cannot cope with the situation, particularly in view of the pandemic as well. So Syria said that any Lebanese that wanted treatment in Syria, they would be welcomed, they would be looked after. Similarly, Iraq has sent 5 plane loads of food and medicines, etc., to help the Lebanese people. And all of these governments have said that they will do more. I'm talking about Iran, Syria, and Iraq. Whereas, you know, as you mentioned, you look at the Western countries issuing threats, demanding reforms. Sure, there need to be reforms, but that is something that the Lebanese people and the government have to decide, not to be dictated from outside.
By the way, can you identify who was it that created this peculiar arrangement of power in Lebanon where it is done by on a confessional basis?
It was France. And absolutely, it was France that created this nonsensical thing instead of allowing the Lebanese people to decide their own future. And this confessional arrangement is so out of sync with reality that, you know, it insists that the president has to be a Maronite Christian, that the prime minister has to be a Sunni Muslim, and that the speaker of the Lebanese parliament has to be a Shia Muslim, and the head of the armed forces has to be a Druze. I mean, so it's a hodgepodge of things over there, and it takes no account of the actual population composition of you know, what it constitutes. In fact, you know, this colonial setup has to be abolished. There has to be added franchise for all people, treated as equal. No guaranteed posts to people, and, you know, whatever government the people of Lebanon elect, that should be allowed to function. But regrettably, we have this very curious colonial type setup over there, which has prevented Lebanon from making progress. And it's right now in very, very deep financial crises, made worse by sanctions imposed by it and all kinds of foreign interference in its affairs from the Saudis, from the French, from the Americans, from the British. Right now, there is an American, you know, naval ship outside the port of Beirut. There are even British and French troops in Beirut. This is reported by some Lebanese on their, you know, Instagram and Facebook pages. And you say that, you know, this is what, and of course there are Israeli drones flying overhead. So you say that, you know, we are supposed to.
About that, I mean, I think our listeners might be surprised to know this, but Hezbollah has said they're perfectly comfortable with the idea of a fresh constitution where it is a democratic order and you vote for who you want.
Absolutely, exactly.
Which the Canadian Parliament will not recognize and has helped add to the whole headache by trying to deny an elected group in the Lebanese political system.
Exactly. In fact, you know, Hezbollah is a major component of the Lebanese parliament. It has more than 20 members, and with its allies, that includes the Amal faction as well as some Maronite Christians, etc., it is able to work with all factions because it wants to serve Lebanon's interests, not any sectarian interests. So Currently, the Lebanese parliament essentially has a considerable number of members, the majority, that are supportive of Hezbollah's position. And Hezbollah has always called for one vote, one person, and fair sort of, you know, arrangement so that the Lebanese people would rise above their sectarian and confessional loyalties and work as Lebanese citizens so that they can elect their own government.
Yes. Now we're speaking to Zafar Benghesh, and an eminent journalist and authority on this region. Zafar, I have to take this to this other looming crisis. Well, I shouldn't call it a crisis. It seems to be maybe a petty political move, maneuver. That is, the UAE, the mighty, huge, important UAE, has announced they're going to establish diplomatic relations with Israel. And then Israel, and for their part, say, well, if they're going to do that, we will not take parts of the West Bank that were scheduled to be annexed. There seems to be a little matter of the Golan Heights not discussed. But anyhow, what is your who is the UAE? How big a country? How important are they?
Well, one of the things that I think we need to keep in mind is that many of these Arab regimes are tiny players. I mean, the UAE's total population, its own population, is something like 1.8 or 2 million. And it's made up of seven small groupings, which includes Dubai, Ajman, and Ailan, etc. So all of the, altogether, the Abu Dhabi happens to be the largest of the groupings and also overall in charge, and that's what constitutes the UAE. And their announcement to establish diplomatic relations with Israel had been in the works for quite a while, because there have been contacts between them since 1990. It's not something new. But of course, they could never really bring themselves to openly declare that. There have been recent visits, as recent as October of 2018 by some Israeli ministers. And then in July of 2019, the Israeli foreign minister visited the UAE under the pretext of attending the UN climate change summit, etc. So there were contacts at very high level, and they were constantly trying to maneuver their way in order to be able to make this formal announcement. Now, what has led to this formal announcement? I believe two, three things are at work. The first is that obviously Donald Trump was behind this, and Donald Trump is facing difficulties for his re-election bid come November. And so he wanted some kind of a success to show that, you know, he managed to work his way through to get the UAE to accept or recognize Israel. Secondly, we know that the current Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is involved in a number of cases. These are political scandals, corruption cases against him, nepotism, etc. And over the last couple of weeks or so, there have been massive demonstrations in Israel itself against Netanyahu, demanding his resignation because of these corruption charges against him. Now, why did the UAE do it at this time? I believe that the UAE is trying to undercut Turkey and Iran's growing influence. Now, these two countries are also coming closer to each other. And now we see that Pakistan is also getting in, because there were, in the last few days, there were reports about Pakistan sort of distancing itself from Saudi Arabia, that it had basically been tied to for the last 70 years. And so it would indicate to me that the UAE move is essentially aimed at trying to undermine Iran and Turkey, as well as to serve Israeli-American interests, or at least serve the interests of their unpopular leaders. And there is also within the Arab countries, apart from Egypt, the rest of the Arab countries are, you know, very, very weak in terms of their military strength. And UAE is just a tiny little country, even though Saudi Arabia is much bigger, but Saudi Arabia's army is pathetic. You know, I can tell you firsthand from, you know, Pakistani military officers that served in Saudi Arabia who used to train these people, and they have a very low opinion of the Saudi soldiers and even officers. They say that they're just so pathetic. They simply cannot even carry out ordinary tasks, let alone any.
They haven't been able to defeat tiny, poor Yemen.
Exactly. Like, you know, Yemen has been bombarded, and, you know, millions of people are on the verge of starvation. And yet, for more than 5 years, the Saudis have been attacking Yemen, and they haven't made an inch of progress apart from destroying Yemen's infrastructure. But the Saudis dare not invade Yemen by their own military forces. They've been trying to recruit mercenaries from around the world. They wanted Egyptian forces. The Egyptians refused. Then they went to Africa. They got some African countries to get their mercenaries. They had even urged Pakistan, who flatly refused and said, no, we are not going to get involved in this. It is a quagmire. And they even told the Saudis, advised the Saudis not to attack Yemen. So, as you pointed out, that the Saudi army is so incompetent. Even the Emiratis are involved there, but they have now pulled out because they realize that this is a mess. We cannot do anything about it. All we will end up is losing more and more soldiers. So the Emiratis have pulled out their forces, but they are basically trying to pay their you know, allies or mercenaries in Yemen to continue to wage this fight and to get mercenaries from outside to fight in Yemen.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Zafar Benghash, and I've seen some speculation. Trump, probably unfortunately for his few friends in the Middle East, he said there's going to be more. So is he referring to Saudi Arabia, and is he daydreaming, or what's that about?
No, he's not daydreaming. Actually, I think what is happening is that there is no doubt that the UAE decision was coordinated with the Saudis. But I don't think that the Saudis are going to do it immediately. What I foresee is probably Bahrain, followed by Oman. These are two other tiny countries. Bahrain, because it is also the home to the U.S. Fifth Fleet. And I think it is quite likely. Bahrain is tiny, and in fact, last year, before the U.S. announced its so-called deal of the century, there was a donors conference held in Bahrain, in which the Americans pushed the Arab regimes to fork out $100 billion to sell this deal of the century. Of which about $10 billion was going to be paid to the Palestinian Authority, which to its credit repudiated that out of hand. And they said that you cannot make decisions on our behalf. You have not consulted us. You have not, you know, even bothered to come to us. So even the Palestinian Authority, which has for decades acted under Israeli control, and yet even they couldn't accept such a silly arrangement or such an insulting arrangement. And so Bahrain was used as a platform so that that so-called deal of the century financial component could be launched, which came to naught. It didn't succeed. And so it is highly likely that Bahrain may be the next country after, I think, a cooling off period. They just want to see how the reaction is going to be around, particularly in the Middle East, as well as the Muslim world, to the UAE decision. And then perhaps Oman might follow after that. And then after that, Saudi Arabia may make a public announcement. Although under the cover or covertly, there are a lot of contacts between the Saudis and the Israelis that are taking place, and there have even been speculation that perhaps in 2018, the Saudi crown prince, who essentially is the de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia, had even made a secret trip to Tel Aviv to meet Israeli officials. So there are undercurrents over there, but I don't think that Saudis would necessarily jump into it right away. They probably would wait for one or two other countries before they would do so.
So the states that are contemplating this and want to do it is every last absolute monarchy.
Yes, exactly. Absolutely.
Going to unite with the beacon of democracy and the only, what is it that Stephen Bliss called it, the only democratic state in the Middle East? What a joke.
It's just an absolute joke because, you know, they deny not only the Palestinian people, but also others.
We have to remind people, they are making trouble for themselves, the Arab people, Arab nation, and Muslims. They all understand this is humiliating. So they have to be isolating themselves in their own countries even more than they already are as absolute monarchs.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, you know, there are a lot of rumblings of discontent inside Saudi Arabia. I wouldn't say the same thing for UAE because, as I said, it's a tiny country. It is quite rich and it is able to control its population quite effectively. Incidentally, again, the control that is exercised in the UAE even before the Israelis established the UAE announced establishment of diplomatic relations with Israel, Israel was controlling UAE security operations at least for the last 2 to 3 years. In fact, in Abu Dhabi itself, on their roads, there are security cameras every 1 kilometer. And all of this has been set up by the Israelis.
Yes, that sort of thing. They're very quick to denounce it if in Asia. They talk about nothing else when they talk about China. But you're telling me every kilometer you got security cameras in one
Correct.
Of our...
And not only that, all of this information goes to Israel. That is where it is monitored from. You can see what is going on here.
Yeah, you have to be a headquarters.
Yes.
We're speaking to Zafar Benghazi, and Zafar, again, we couldn't, these events couldn't be coming faster and more actually precipitous. What is the story, I know this is kind of unfolding, this matter of the ships that America, being a pirate country, says that they have seized somewhere and are going to take them to, I think, Texas. They are allegedly have Iranian fuel destined for Venezuela, which is, of course, under sanctions and is supposed to fall down on their face and starve because the United States wants to do that to them. What are these? What's the story of the three ships in your view?
Well, from what I have been able to gather so far, Iran's government has denied that these ships belong to them. They are certainly not Iranian-flagged tankers. Iran had sent in May and June about 5 tankers going to Venezuela, and all of the 5 tankers were able to reach Venezuela to deliver oil as well as oil products, as well as food and other items that were needed by Venezuela. So we will have to wait and see what is the story about these tankers and who owns them, or at least who owns the oil. But I would accept what Iran says, that these tankers do not belong to Iran. Because, you know, Iran is not shy about admitting if it owns something. They are quite open about it. They fly their own flag openly. And when they were actually sending their oil tankers and ships, et cetera, to Venezuela, they openly declared that if the U.S. were to try to intercept any of these ships or prevent them from reaching there, then there are going to be consequences. kind of do anything. But it could have done, if they wanted to, they could have done something, for instance, in the Caribbean Sea, tens of thousands of miles away from Iran's shores, but they didn't, because they knew that there are going to be repercussions. Iran has the ability to cause problems for shipping in the Persian Gulf and in the Arabian Sea outside the Persian Gulf. So the Americans didn't dare do that. So we'll have to wait and see exactly what happens with respect to these oil tankers. But I think I would want to point out that, you know, as you mentioned in your introduction, that there was this vote in the Security Council on August 14th. Now, the U.S. was pushing for this to impose or extend the arms embargo against Iran that would expire in October as part of the nuclear deal that Iran signed with the P5+2 countries back in July of 2015, and it came into effect in January of 2016. Under that agreement, Iran had agreed to limit its nuclear enrichment, and that the arms embargo that has been imposed on Iran would expire in October of this year. And this was also confirmed by UN Security Council Resolution 2231 in October of 2016. Now, the U.S. has repudiated that agreement with Iran. It pulled out of it in May of 2018, and yet it says that it has the right to extend these sanctions, what are referred to as snapback sanctions. And as we saw from the Security Council vote, with the exception of the Dominican Republic, the other 13 countries did not support the U.S. position. So it is a slap in the face of the United States that considers itself a superpower. And yet in the Security Council, where it wields a veto right, it was only able to muster one country to support it, and that also a tiny country like the Dominican Republic, and nobody else, not even the U.S.'s allies, Britain, France, and Germany, voted for the U.S. They actually abstained. And so the U.S. motion was defeated in the Security Council, and China spoke that, you know, just the U.S. has already walked out of this agreement, and it cannot come back and say that no, it wants to use the same nuclear agreement to impose sanctions on Iran when it has already repudiated that agreement. So it cannot have it both ways, and it's in no position to be doing things like that.
Yeah, here you have what the United States loves to refer to as the international community, which they say they lead, and they lost to their own base, their own community didn't support them.
Exactly. I mean, I think the only country they're leading now is the Dominican Republic.
Yeah, and I bet they're arguing about that in the Dominican Republic.
Exactly.
We're speaking to Zafar Bengash in the minutes remaining. Zafar, there's a festering question in Syria, and the Syrian army, under tremendous blows from the West, with Obama leading the way, nobody should forget it was his idea to destroy Syria. And he said that the president had to step down because he, President Obama, says that he has to step down. And terrorists flocked into the country. Now, many years of battle, and the Syrian army has pretty much prevailed in most parts of the country. But there are places where they have yet to finish the job because they're faced with special problems. So one of them has to be Idlib, which is close to the Turkish border. It's been at least a year, maybe two, I'm losing track, when basically they've cornered the worst elements. Can you tell us who is in Idlib and how is that, in your view, going to be resolved?
Well, these are the hardcore terrorists that have flooded into Syria. And the U.S. Army is also there, incidentally. About 2,000 U.S. troops are there. And these U.S. troops, as well as a U.S. air base, Al-Tanf, from which, incidentally, last month, the U.S. Air Force planes had flown in order to basically harass and cause major problems for a civilian Iranian airliner that was flying from Tehran to Beirut, the Mahan airline flight, in which the pilot had to take serious evasive action in order to prevent a collision from occurring. And the excuse that the United States offered was that they wanted to make sure that it wasn't a military plane flying over there because they have their Air Force base at Al-Tanf. And the Syrian government immediately retorted and said that you are illegally occupying our land. We have not given you permission to be there, nor for your 2,000 troops. So you should get out rather than jeopardizing civilian airliners, which is a major crime. Yes. Now, in Idlib province itself, there are several thousand of these mercenaries that are holed up. Although there were recent reports that the Syrian army captured a huge arms depot in Idlib province. And basically, these hardcore terrorists are supported and supplied by the United States. And of course, unfortunately, Turkey is also playing that role in allowing these mercenaries to go back and forth across its border. And so the Syrian army is prevented from reclaiming the last pockets of its territory. But essentially, Syria has regained most of its territory except for a few pockets in Idlib province. Mm-hmm. And so, unfortunately, that is the situation that stands at the present time. And the Syrian army is, of course, very careful not to directly confront Turkish armed forces because it would create a major problem for the Syrian army, nor does it want to take on the American army directly because then America would use that as a pretext to carry out a massive bombing campaign of Syria and also flood more troops into the country. So Syria is gradually inching towards liberating its territory, but not completely.
We should just, in closing, I want to ask you, and this is a reason why people living in Canada and the United States and the West who are looking to see Mr. Trump go away, they should understand that Joe Biden is one of those Americans who likes the idea of further intervention in Syria. They wanted they wanted a no-fly zone.
Yes.
This is who is likely, because of COVID-19, I suspect, but most likely to take power. So Syria has a real challenge.
You are right. You see, it was Cindy Sheehan, whose son, Casey, was killed in Iraq in April of 2014. And she, Cindy Sheehan, actually made a very, very perceptive statement. She said that there aren't two political parties in the United States, the Democrats and the Republicans. There is only one political party in the United States, and that is the war party. So anybody, any American who harbors the illusion that one party is going to be different from the other, they don't really understand how the American political system works. Not only that, basically, the entire American political system is held hostage to this military, industrial, corporate banking complex that manipulates U.S. policy, and they insist they are actually addicted to wars. So I don't think anybody should have any illusions that you know, a Biden presidency is going to be any less dangerous than a Trump presidency.
Zafar Bengash, brilliant as always. We really appreciate it, and our listeners should be very glad. You have covered a lot of territory. We thank you very, very much.
It's my great pleasure, Phil. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye now.